It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll hear about a new effort to save one of the state's tribal languages.
First, Republican state lawmakers are working to approve the two-year Wisconsin state budget before July 1st, the beginning of the next fiscal year. There are several sticking points, though. Transportation funding, financing a new Buck Stadium in Milwaukee, and the prevailing wage law.
Sean Johnson is back with us to check in on these issues. He's the state government reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, let's start with this transportation funding issue. This has been one of the biggest sticking points. Where are we now on this?
I think we're about where we've been for a while now, and that is no deal. The governor proposed borrowing $1.3 billion for transportation in the budget he introduced, you know, back this winter. Republicans said pretty much from day one, Republican lawmakers, that is, that was going to be a problem. They weren't going to be able to support that. And that's kind of where we are today. I mean, negotiations have been going on this topic for quite a while now. Republicans say they're looking at reducing that bonding by quite a bit. But obviously, here we are in mid-June, and the Budget Committee hasn't met for a few weeks now. So they've hit a wall on this.
And we've talked over the last year about different proposals to increase revenues in different ways to pay for roads, gas tax, user fees, that sort of thing. As far as we know, unless something's happened behind closed doors, those are still off the table, right?
It does. It sounds like they're still off the table. The biggest fee increase that Republicans really kind of rallied around, you heard both legislative leaders say that they would consider adding this to the budget, was a vehicle registration fee increase. And that was by no means going to wipe out all of that $1.3 million in bonding, but it would be a new source of revenue that the state would use to pay for roads instead of just putting it all on the credit card. So it's a rare step to hear two Republican legislative leaders come out and say, yep, we would do that. We'd raise that fee. But the governor came out almost immediately and said, no, I will veto that. Or, you know, while he might not have used the veto word, he said, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Right. So that's where we're at. And so without new revenue, he's opposed to new revenue. They're opposed to the borrowing. And so now the question is, how much are they going to cut borrowing? And beyond that, the question is, are they going to kind of prescribe where the state spends what transportation dollars are left? You know, are they going to pick and choose, they being lawmakers, the projects that get money and the projects that get delayed?
So that's currently planned projects, either delaying them or maybe canceling them. I don't know. But once you open that door, that opens the door to a lot of negotiations about where these things happen, whose districts they happen in, it seems to me.
Exactly. It becomes less of a partisan issue and more of a regional issue. You know, if lawmakers in southeast Wisconsin got most of their transportation projects paid for in the last few budgets, and now they're objecting to this new borrowing that would have helped a transportation project in a district somewhere else in Wisconsin, that's going to breed some infighting there among Republicans. And it's part of the reason we haven't seen a lot from them lately. I mean, they've been doing all their meeting behind closed doors to try to get a deal on this.
So, as you said, we are now where we have been for a while. Probably something's going to come out from somewhere. Any expectation of when that's going to happen?
We keep saying that they're going to meet any time. I mean, there was a thought that the Finance Committee was going to meet this week, potentially today. They did not meet today. And the governor actually had a conference call with reporters this morning, said he was hoping that the Finance Committee would meet this week sometime. Joint Finance Committee co-chair Alberta Darling told the Associated Press, no, that's not going to happen. They're not going to meet this week. So we'll say maybe next week again, but we've been saying that for a while now.
Talking to Sean Johnson, WPR state government reporter, about sticking points for the state budget, sort of due by the beginning of next month, though many times in the past the budget has taken longer than that. So from transportation, Sean, to the Bucks Arena. This is another one we've been talking about quite a while. It's there in the budget. I guess the first question is, why is it in the budget and is it going to stay there?
I think probably the shortest, most honest answer is it's in the budget because it's easier to pass when it's part of the budget. I mean, there are all sorts of elements to this plan that have to do with state money. So you can make, from a policy perspective, you can make a pretty good argument for putting it in the budget. But the reason it's there is likely to get the votes to pass this thing. The governor wants to pass it. polling has shown it's not politically popular in Wisconsin to borrow public money for a sports arena, and especially for a lot of lawmakers who don't live in the Milwaukee media market. It's not a politically popular idea to borrow state funds or borrow any funds for this this arena. So it's there. The governor has really pushed on it. But I think from what you're hearing from the leaders of the budget committee, Republican lawmakers who chair that committee, it may come out of the budget that they think that they're going to need Democratic support to get this through. And given that no Democrats are going to vote for the budget, they're saying we got to take this out and pass it as a standalone bill so that we can get Democrats, particularly Milwaukee Democrats, on board.
And this is happening because despite support for an agreement reached earlier this month from the Republican governor and Republican leaders of each house of the legislature, a lot of rank-and-file Republicans not willing to get on board with this, it sounds like.
Yeah, there are. This is one of those rare issues where you actually have legislators from both parties on both sides of this issue. I mean, you've heard some conservatives really rally against this and say that we shouldn't be in the business of crony capitalism. Some liberals saying, look, this at a time when we're cutting the University of Wisconsin and other valuable state programs, the last thing we should be doing is spending state money, valuable state money, on a sports arena. So this is one of those really rare issues where people aren't going to fall along party lines, and it makes it especially challenging to get votes for the plan. And, you know, making it more challenging to get those votes is the details aren't exactly out there yet. I mean, the governor laid out his plan a little while ago and said, look, it's just in his words, it was just a fact that the state was better off doing this financially than if it let the bucks go. But we still don't have a bill. We don't have language on how this is going to work. The Legislative Fiscal Bureau hasn't had a chance to crunch the numbers and say, what's this going to mean? And so you have a lot of questions out there for rank-and-file lawmakers who are being asked to vote for this.
Now, another issue holding up the budget, as I understand it, ending the state's prevailing wage law. What's the story and the latest there?
Yeah, this is a Republican dispute over what to do with prevailing wage. And prevailing wage is basically like a base wage that the state pays for government construction projects. And it can have the effect of paying union wages to non-union workers, because the government conducts a survey of what contractors are paying for a certain type of job in a certain region. That's how it reaches this prevailing wage. Some Republicans say that goes against the idea of the free market. This is an idea whose time has passed. We've got these huge Republican majorities. Let's get rid of prevailing wage. Some Republicans have said their vote for this budget depends on getting rid of prevailing wage. There are other Republicans who say, look, I don't want to do that. We don't have the votes to do that. And so there's another big one that's holding up the budget.
And then a tax cut package or tax reform package, another one that's caused debates. As I understand it, one piece of this that we've talked about on the show, getting rid of the alternative minimum tax, that's off the table for now.
It sounds like it. And this one's holding things up. And this is an example of an issue that we didn't even really know about, that it was being still debated or negotiated. Until last week, it came out that Republicans were looking at ending the alternative minimum tax, which is primarily paid by people who earn more than $200,000. They wanted to get rid of that and shift that tax burden to other taxpayers, and that would be a $63 million shift in the next state budget, so it's a pretty big deal. They were talking about getting rid of that. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said yesterday they probably won't go with their original plan, but he was pretty vague on what they will do.
All right. We'll be watching that in the couple of weeks till the unofficial deadline. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us as always.
You're welcome, Ron.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR state government reporter, talking about issues holding up state lawmakers from passing the new 2-year budget for Wisconsin.
Last month, a new educational collaboration between the Ho-Chunk Nation and a UW college was announced. Its goal to preserve the Ho-Chunk language for generations to come.
The new initiative comes as fewer and fewer are speaking the language. It's estimated that only 100 people are proficient Ho-Chunk speakers. That's a number that's decreased over the last 4 years. So how will this new collaboration help to try and turn things around?
John Greendeer joins us now. He's the president of the Ho-Chunk Nation. President Greendeer, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me.
So first off, tell us about what this new collaboration will entail.
Well, sure. Thank you. Well, we're absolutely excited to partner up with the UW College's system in working in a relatively new angle and approach to certify language teachers so that we can start expanding the number of apprentices who have learned, instructors, so that we can start utilizing those and have them credentialed out through the process so that they can be available in the school districts and provide that expansion of education in our language.
How important do you think it will be to have those language ambassadors for the Ho-Chunk language to work with the generations coming up?
Well, absolutely very important. I think for the most part, a lot of Wisconsinites know that the Ho-Chunk people don't have a contiguous land base, and that's a big factor and obstacle that we deal with in providing any type of thing, whether it's language revitalization or even just general government services. And so it means that we have to take a lot of partnerships with local school districts, law enforcement agencies, medical providers, and so that our government is uniquely expanded across mostly the southwestern portion of the state. And so with that comes our partnerships with the pre-K through 12, and also the colleges. So this is very important that we provide that expansion out to our communities, because there's a very good chance, especially in southwestern portion of the state, that you're going to have at least one Ho-Chunk student in your school district.
Now, so for those people who are unfamiliar with the Ho-Chunk language, who is it that's keeping the language alive today? It sounds like it's down to around 100 people speaking it. Who are those people?
Right. Well, they're the most amazing people on earth in our world. They may not be fluent, all of them, but I think they have a job that's a lot harder than I could ever imagine. And they're not the only ones responsible for that. I think their work depends on the nucleus of people around them and their supporters and providing all these alternative ways of learning the language, because there's no one-size-fits-all. So these people are typically our premier or elite speakers, people that have spoken the Ho-Chunk language as their first language primarily. And then the students that have worked with them for several years, or close family members that have a very good understanding of the language and use it commonly, conversationally, and use it as a utility in their communication. So they're not simply just individuals who have learned from a book or learned from a couple lessons here and there. These are people that use the Ho-Chunk language on a practical basis. So these are, I would place as our most premier and elite members of the Ho-Chunk Nation, because the language really is everything. It encompasses everything of who we are.
Are you pretty conversant in Ho-Chunk yourself?
Actually, I have made myself able to understand the Ho-Chunk language as much as possible, and it took a lot of work, and I can understand how difficult it is to go from a level one speaker to being very cognitive of conversational Ho-Chunk, and that is difficult. So I do understand the Ho-Chunk language. I do try to speak, and I know that it's not perfect Ho-Chunk. I don't think there's ever such a thing, but I can communicate, and it's very important to me. It has a very deep value, and I think that anyone that has embarked on learning the Ho-Chunk language really feels the value of that language right away. So it's our hope that having this partnership and expanding that, and even getting someone into the Ho-Chunk Level 1 courses, and we believe that value will be set. And right now we're starting to see, as we see the number of elite speakers decrease, we're starting to see the interest of learning increase. So it's kind of a unique diorama with a lot of eager students coming to learn the language, but we're losing the most important core of it, and those are our first language speakers.
What do you think is so meaningful about those young people coming up who want to learn it? What's so meaningful to them about being part of this language and being able to speak it?
Prior to my learning a little bit more of the language, I often heard this reinforced upon our communities, our families, our households, was if you don't know the language, you don't really know the culture. And it sounds great, especially if you hear someone running for office and doing all these wonderful things, but in actuality, there's an absolute truth to that. I found out by learning more of the language that I actually have more questions about us than I ever had before. And there are just certain expressions and things that we would say in our language that we could never say in English or find the equivalent thereof. We could never, sometimes we just never would say something like we would in English. And so it really tells about who we were as a people, that, you know, we're a very humble people. We're a very giving people. We're a very thankful people. And I honestly don't think we could really embody who we are in the English language. So I think it really is important. And the people that are teaching it, our apprentices, our workers, our curriculum developers, everyone plays a major role in to when they bring this back, they're bringing back our culture, our identity of who we are.
How hopeful are you about this effort, this partnership, and its prospects for reviving the Ho-Chunk language and bringing up a new generation of speakers?
I'm very hopeful. I really feel that our collective mentality, because of the past, and rightfully, if you use past to see where you're at today, to project where you're going to be at in the future, it doesn't look good. But I really think that we have to approach this with some optimism, because we do have those households where the young people are speaking Ho-Chunk, and you hear your own native language being spoken by a 5-year-old or a 7-year-old, and they're speaking with it confidently, and you hear that, it's very inspiring, and you really see the legacy of what we're trying to do from all different angles, whether it be from an app for your iPhone, all the way to actual text curriculum, to language apprentice programs, to master speakers, to immersion. I really think that there's so many different approaches. And, you know, while we start to realize that there's no right or wrong way to approach this.
President Greendeer, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate that.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time on this very, very important subject. You guys have a—
That was John Greendeer, president of the Ho-Chunk Nation, joining us to talk about a new initiative to preserve the Ho-Chunk language for generations to come.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll take a look at the new national job numbers out today and why Wisconsin found itself toward the bottom of the list.
First, last night, the U.S. women's national soccer team beat Nigeria in the Women's World Cup. That puts the team in first place in Group D. They'll head to the first match of the knockout stage on Monday in Edmonton.
The Women's World Cup is drawing millions of viewers around the world, more than any women's sport in the world. But our next guest says once the World Cup is over, the excitement about women's soccer will subside and the sport will again sink into obscurity.
Andre Markovitz is back with us to talk about the Women's World Cup and why women's sports aren't more popular. He's a professor of political science and German studies at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and he's the co-author of Offside, Soccer and American Exceptionalism, and Sportista, Female Fandom in the United States. Andy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Delighted to be back, and also hello to Veronica.
Well, let's start with this Women's World Cup. This went from nothing to a big deal in a relatively short period of time. How did that happen?
It's events. These are, you know, major things, it's above all driven by national identification. And Jerry Seinfeld so beautifully called laundry. Basically, people root for whatever it says on front of the jersey, in this case USA or Canada or Germany or whatever. And this has become a huge event. I mean, I don't know last night's data, but the Sweden game last Friday garnered 4.4 million viewers on Fox. I mean, that's huge. And I actually would love to see how it yesterday's game stacked up against Game 6 of the NBA Finals. obvious. I'm sure it was much less, but still, I'm sure it did very well. And it's everything to do with, you know, you and the two of you and me and everybody else following a wonderful event, wanting our women to win. I actually have my doubts and fears, but that's a different topic. And, you know, and basically this has very little to do with the general popularity of women's soccer. Meaning following of the national Women's Soccer League, NWSL. I'm sure most of you listeners don't even know them, know this league with its nine teams. So what I'm saying here is that there is a huge gap between this massive event, which is followed, which is these players are, we see them as great athletes that they are, and we are very passionate about them, but that is a different story from being passionate about soccer.
Why do you separate the two? Why separate people's feelings about women's soccer and the massive popularity of the Women's World Cup going on right now?
Well, because very simple, because the U.S.-Sweden game garners 4.4 million people, and a match between, let's say, the Portland Thorns and the Western New York Flash, doesn't even make it on television. And if it does, its viewership is minuscule. It's just not registered. I'm not making it a qualitative issue. It's just a question of what, in fact, is registered in terms of greater attention. You are having me on precisely because of the World Cup, not because of a regular season soccer game. So it's not, I don't make a distinction in terms of the sport or the validity of the, I'm just making a distinction of how much, what a different thing this is. By the way, not only in the United States, the same in Europe. I mean, I follow the German media very closely. It's huge. The German team, by the way, I think will win the Cup. They're very, very strong. Huge event. The minute the World Cup is over, the women's game completely recedes in terms of attention, and it doesn't come close to what the men's game is.
So looking long-term trends, let's step outside of soccer now to women's sports in general. Do you see a growing interest in women's sports outside of these big international events, the Olympics and World Cup, or are we more or less where we were a decade, two decades ago?
No, we're not where we are. First of all, we're not what we are 2 decades ago, and we're certainly not what we were where we were 4 decades ago. I mean, just look at how many women's sports are now completely accepted. At my own University of Michigan in 1970, I think there was literally not one varsity athlete. Now it's almost 50%, and the same at your University of Wisconsin. So clearly we're miles away. I mean, the first World Cup in 1991 was held in China in the middle of, or at the end of November. It was almost an embarrassment for FIFA. They almost hid it. It was completely not on anyone's radar. By 1999, it becomes huge. To this day, by the way, the largest event attended by women was the women's final between the United States and China. So clearly, amazing transition. But what these sports are not is that they are not daily fare of constant obsession, of talk, of discussion, of worry, as are these what I have called hegemonic sports, the big four in the United States, namely football, basketball, baseball, and hockey, and soccer in the rest of the world, although not everywhere, but in other countries, some countries it's cricket and some rugby games. But these are cultures which are daily. I mean, I just before going on with you, I heard the news about Bart Starr. I mean, Bart Starr has not played in decades, but yet, of course, he is an icon not only in Wisconsin but in all of the United States. And this is very different in terms of women's team sports, not individual sports. Certainly, women's tennis players have the equivalent star power, and people are talking about them. But, of course, it's also easier for tennis players because they have four Grand Slams every year. Women's soccer players play once every 4 years to the same audience. Very, very difficult.
We're talking right now with Andre Markovitz. He's the author of Sportista, Female Fandom in the United States. We're talking about the Women's World Cup and women's sports in general. And Andy, why do you think that is, that we have these smash hit things like the World Cup and it doesn't transform itself into a fan base that's regular and steady for women's sports or women's soccer in this case?
Well, you have to give it time. The men have been at it for 130, 140 years. The women for, even if we call the World Cup, it's basically 25. So give it some time. But ultimately, I actually think that what is at issue here is that following sports or sports consumption has a very different valence, has a very different importance to men as it is for women. To put it crudely, for men, it is the most important lingua franca. It is the language that the CEO and the janitor have, and that is absolutely part of their male identity. It's in fact beyond religion, which is a taboo. It's certainly the salaries of what you make is taboo. Politics you don't talk about, but you talk sports, and sports is absolutely an integral part of what it means to be this. This is just not the case for women. Women are, if you will, much more multilingual. They talk about other things, and they follow a team, they love a team, they are completely identified with the team, but it's less in terms of its history, in terms of its larger comparative analyses, in terms of its obsessing with various statistics. So I'm of course talking about the norm. I'm not talking about the ESPN journalists, who of course are completely in this, the female journalists, or obviously people. There are women who are completely as behaving like your most obsessed sports nerd. But I'm just talking about the average behavior. And to women, this is less important. To men, it is very important.
So, Andy, does this mean that a female market of fans isn't going to drive the success of women's sports?
I think it's, yes, partly, absolutely. I think it needs both. It needs men and women. And in fact, we know that in tennis, it has that. And it clearly has that for the World Cup. Men watch this game. It really needs both. It will not be just carried by women alone.
What do you think it will take in terms of time? You said give it a little bit of time. Given that, what else needs to go into that equation to build the women's sports base?
You mean the women's fan base?
Right.
Well, the women's fan base on some level is, of course, perfectly fine and healthy. If you look, the NFL, something like 40% of the NFL's fan base is female. You can go to any NFL game and you see all kinds of items tailored to the female fan. But clearly, the female fan watches and sees something different than the male fan. It's a different language to them, okay? And this means that certainly you can have, in terms of consumption, you can have women following these sports. But for them to become daily fair, basically sports talk radio, a long-term interest about what happens to the Western New York Flash, whom should they trade, whom should they not trade, why the coach is an idiot, why he should play so or she should play so-and-so more up front rather than in the middle, why should she be playing a 4-4-3 rather than a 4, okay? As long as this is not an obsessive kind of real part of women's culture, they will consume the sport differently, which means that it will be much more event and team driven rather than, if you will, a sort of abstraction, a form of which has nothing to do with the teams per se, but a kind of history and numbers and things like that, which is so essential to men's discourse of sports.
We're talking right now to Andre Markovitz. He's the author of Sportista, Female Fandom in the United States, talking about women's sports and the Women's World Cup.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Are you watching? Are you following the Women's World Cup? Do you watch women's sports or a particular women's sport in general? Why? Why not? Why do you think they're not more popular? What would it take to get you more interested in women's sports? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion now with sports expert Andre Markovitz about why women's sports aren't more popular.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What would it take to get you into women's sports? Is there a women's sport that you follow? What is it? What makes the difference? Are you rooting for Team USA in the Women's World Cup? After it's over, are you going to check out women's professional soccer in the country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Andy, before we go to calls, I mean, there's a new generation of soccer players, many girls playing soccer. I'm raising two of them. We're being begged for Alex Morgan jerseys. Megan Rapinoe's coming up now. We may need to get one of those. Are those fans of the future who are maybe going to be more into the women's game, maybe drive its success as a sport outside of the World Cup?
I hope so. I hope so. Absolutely. That makes a huge, huge difference. Although, just because one plays a sport, I think you said something very important, that they're not only your girls, they're not only are playing soccer, because they've been playing actually since the 1990s. In fact, very few countries have more organized soccer players than the United States, half of whom have always been girls or young women, but that they, in fact, now have their heroes. So there's a big difference between doing a sport and following a sport. We do many, many, many sports. In fact, virtually all Olympic sports are actually performed, but we don't follow them. Very few of us follow a shot put or the 100-meter butterfly or on and on. These are quadrennial things, and we're rooting for them and watching them because, again, it says USA on their jerseys or on their swim trunks or whatever. We don't really follow it the way we do these four team sports that are part of our daily culture. And for that to happen, you need identifiers. And I think what I'm most encouraged by is that your daughters do want a Megan Rapinoe or an Alex Morgan T-shirt. That is the key thing here. Not only that they're playing soccer, but that they, in fact, are now following soccer.
We're going to go to our callers now. We've got Jared on the line in Madison. Hi, Jared.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
So, regarding women's sports, I absolutely would love to follow it. I watch UW women's hockey occasionally, but it does get really boring, and it's upsetting that their rules are not on par with the men's. And regarding hockey, women aren't allowed to check each other, and I like watching hockey, and I like the physical activity in the game, not only the skill, but being able to watch them slam up against the boards and everything, and the disparity between the men's game and the women's game, it's off-putting. And I think that actually is a factor that plays into a lot of why we can't get into it.
Jared, thanks a lot for that call. And Andy, I know that's something you've thought a bit about too, whether athleticism matches women's sports and men's sports.
Yeah, I would have. I'd like to follow up on what the caller said. I would just advise him to really put on different glasses. I actually am also one of those rare people. I love women's college, women's hockey. I'm still crushed by the U.S., long puck that actually hit the goalpost, and our women did not win the gold against Canada. But you're watching it in a different way. I don't see it as, so I actually do not look for checking. I enjoyed when I watched the Women's World Cup, and I've been to three Women's World Cups. I followed the U.S. team in 2011 in Germany. I do not compare it to when I watch my beloved Manchester United, because that's actually unfair. Now, I understand that many people, above all men, do. And this, of course, a priori makes women's sports just not as exciting or not as challenging and so on and so forth. I would just like to point out that, again, I bet that the caller does not feel the same about watching Serena Williams. And yet Serena Williams also is not the equivalent of a top 15, top 20 male player. The point is that once we would get used to watching women's sports, like, for instance, women's volleyball, very few people know that the net is actually much lower for the women. Still, it's immensely exciting. So I don't think that is the issue. The issue is ultimately, you know, that we got to get used to it, that men also follow it some and on its own terms, and that ultimately women really become almost like, I mean, they become men in terms of their passion for women's sports, which they don't have yet. That's the point. In other words, really feel it, feeling for it, really following, really calling up sports radio, obsessing about why this trade was made or not made. That's, I think, the main thing. And I'm not sure whether women will ever do this for maybe probably very good reasons, because ultimately this is not so important in life. So you can have all kinds of reasons why this may not happen. As long as it's completely made out of free volition, I have no problem with this, because there's no inherent virtue to being sports obsessed. In fact, as we see now in soccer in Europe on the male side, it has horrible downsides to it, that obsession leads to kind of partisanship that is way beyond anything, a terrible racism, on and on and on, which actually the women's game does not have. So whenever I went to Women's World Cup, I loved it, because in fact it was about the sport, and it didn't have, you know, horrible Nazi slogans, all this horrible stuff that is part of the men's game.
We're talking
because of the passion.
We're talking women's sports with Andy Markovitz. We'll go back to our callers with Jamie in Green Bay. Jamie, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I say this with a lot of hesitation because I'm all about women and women power and feminism, but I have to say, as a female, with a few exceptions, like maybe volleyball, softball, tennis, I prefer watching men play sports, especially when it comes to things like basketball, football. You know, these powder puff leagues happening, or these lingerie football leagues. Of course, I have no need for that at all. I don't know about men, but I don't know what it is, but I prefer it, and I almost even prefer male sportscasters, especially in something like football. I get why they do it. I get that they want a female sportscaster in front of the TV, in front of the microphone, but I and like I said, it's hard for me to say it, but it's as a female, I still prefer it.
All right, Jamie, thanks for the call. Is that an obstacle for women's sports leagues, Andy? Even women, in some cases here, prefer male sports.
I don't want to tout my own book, but for your last caller, she should read, and fits in perfectly into my book, Sportista. Meaning, what is Sportista? Sportistas are those few women who actually have completely assumed male characteristics in terms of their sport following. Namely, they're obsessed, they follow, and indeed they are seen as sort of odd by not only men, but actually also women. And that, in fact, what your last caller did was really confirm our Chapter 3, which looks at your normal American, or actually not only American, also West European sport, female sports fan who actually follows it, but follows the men's sports more because she is more used to it and because it has some cultural meaning to her. If I say, Green Bay Packers, that invokes an entire world of history, of meaning, of smells, of power, of all kinds of immense dimensions in Wisconsin, but also across the country, that women's sports don't have yet. Now, whether they will or not, I don't know. It certainly won't happen in my lifetime, and let's say I have another 20 good years, but it could easily happen in your daughter's when they're adults, if in fact to them sports is as important as it was to you, Rob, and to me. And this is unclear. Certainly it's not clear whether to young girls, even though they love to be Alex Morgan or Megan Rapinoe, but whether they in fact it becomes so salient to their identity. To women, this is a choice. They can or cannot. To men in advanced industrial societies, and actually even beyond that, this actually almost was not a choice. It was, in fact, this is what identified you as male.
And we leave it there. Andy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Andre Markovitz, professor of political science at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. He's also the co-author of Sportista, Female Fandom in the United States. He was with us to talk about women's sports.